Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. It's just gone 6:06. You tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha. And if you happen to find yourself in India on holiday or on business or any other reason, it is illegal in India, or it's not illegal, it requires a permit if you decide to fly a kite in India. One of the craziest laws that we are seeing and exploring, and this is around health or safety concerns from Indian flight or kite fighting competitions. So the Indian Aircraft Act of 1934 came about as a result of some of the injuries that were caused by kite fighting activities. If you happen to find yourself flying a kite in India without a permit, you could be imprisoned for up to 2 years or fined for up to $11,900, which is just shy of $12,000. But that's quite an interesting law. We're going to keep exploring these. Perhaps we'll find out some new laws, strange laws around the world, and we'll see how they make sense. I don't know if this one still does. I suppose the population of India, anyone in India that is listening to the show that has a comment on that, please let us know. But coming up on the show today, we're taking a look at the latest outlook from the team at Investec around fixed investment growth, particularly in infrastructure. They've put out an investment outlook for the infrastructure sector for South Africa as well, to say that that's going to be something that's going to be a driving factor of economic growth for our country in 2025. We've also got a conversation with the team at 361 around the proposed tax changes to unit trusts and collective investment schemes that could significantly impact taxpayers that are invested in these types of products from an asset base. And then we've also got a conversation around donations tax. It seems the South African Revenue Services wants to know if someone buys you a gift, particularly if it is a large gift. And then we wrap things up with a executive lounge segment, the first of the year. We're going to speak to the CEO of Galetti Corporate Real Estate, John Jack, and get a sense of what he does when he's not running the business that he does.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we kick off the show with how the markets have moved throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Sasfin Wealth's David Shapiro to take a look at the market movements. Good evening, Uncle David. Happy 2025 to you. It's lovely to catch up as always. I wish it were under better circumstances, but to be honest, you and I kind of anticipated this coming into this Trump presidency, that we could be in for anything.
We don't. Yeah. Look, it's really unsettled at the moment. I mean, when I read about his son, or these comments about him wanting to annex Canada and then his son in Greenland, you know, you've got to shake your head and say, you know, where are we going? And it is disturbing. I didn't think it would be. I must be honest. I thought it would be a much more muted entrance. But at the moment, markets are unsettled. And I think the other thing that's unsettling market, remember last year when we had the Fed cut rates by 50 points and then another 25. And we thought, okay, we're going to continue that. All of a sudden, that view has changed as well. And now there's a hope of only, you know, there's a view of only one or maybe two rate cuts at the moment. So I think the markets are trying to digest, oh, well, you know, rates higher for longer. What does that mean? So a lot of, the waters are very troubled as we've entered into 2025. No one's quite sure of what you know, of what lies ahead.
We are only 8 days in, and already there is this much chaos. President Trump hasn't officially even taken office. Uncle David, you mentioned on your, I believe it was your LinkedIn page, U.S. exceptionalism would be this year's catchphrase. And I mean, obviously that suggests that the U.S. dominance from an economic perspective is set to continue. How much of that do you think will be down to actual U.S. dominance, and how much of it do you think will be the markets also starting to shift away from the noise that is Donald Trump and his commentary? Because we saw this in his first term, that he's capable of making a lot of noise with very little to follow.
Well, that's what we got to watch for. You know, will he follow through with it? He's not going to say at this stage, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, that's him. He likes to shake things up. He's not a he's not the kind of person, you know, you want to bring to meet your sister or anything like that. You know, he's a very, what's the word? He's a character that causes disturbances. I'm trying to think of an appropriate word. And that's, you know, get used to it. Get used to him. And he's got his little mini-me, Mr. Musk, also running around causing unbelievable trouble, you know, trying to run Germany, trying to run the UK. And sooner or later, he's also going to have his say in what should be happening in America. So, you know, I must say we're looking askance. But Jimmy, in all fairness, you know, you've got a lot of changes. The Canadian president resigns. You've had changes all around the world. So, you know, you try to think straight and against that background. But just one point, it is going to be a decent year. You know, certainly in the U.S., we don't see, with this kind of exceptionalism, I don't think we're going to, you know, you're going to see corporates coming out with pretty decent results. I don't think there's anything that's going to throw that off course. The economy there is still strong. But it's all the other factors that I think that are just creating unbelievable turbulence.
The other factors actually sound like an Austin Powers movie. I mean, we do have all the relevant characters that would fit into that landscape. And I suppose that's what makes for an interesting year. You mentioned that, of course, we're going to have a good year. And we've spoken about this as well, to say we kind of went through the worst that we could go through from a market's perspective over the last even 4 years, if we take from the pandemic. It's almost as if markets can really go in one direction from here. There might be some pullback, there might be some liquidity grabs here and there, but really markets have been under so much pressure that you can't really see anything other than a good 2025 or a better 2025.
Well, rates will come down. You know, rates are going to come down. Inflation is going to come down. So, you know, from that point of view, profitability will increase because companies will have bigger margins. I think the other point I must say is that I thought that AI would start to slow down and that there'd be a broadening out of profitability in the United States. But the more I read, the more this is taking on a new life, and it's actually growing in importance and growing in investment. So I still think it's going to be another tech-driven year. You know, it's still going to be a very, very strong year in that respect. To me, the only thing that is a concern is China. You know, it's not coming through. And, you know, we're waiting at the station for the commodity train to come. And I'm saying, oh, no, please, not another year. You know, we keep hoping that it's going to come, but there's no – and we can't see it in the distance, not even the smoke or the lights or anything. And that's a concern from us, you know, from South Africa's point of view. I'm hoping what you said about Investec's view on infrastructure, that does take place, because that's very, very important for us. You know, especially if they can get private money into infrastructure, that's going to have a huge impact on our growth, you know, laying the foundation for future growth. But we need that, you know, especially when we're not seeing China coming with its commodity boom.
Uncle David, how much of China is going to continue to be a factor for the 2025 year? I mean, I'm looking at the fact that we are 8 days in, and the recent announcements for around Tencent have already rocked the market, and that's already had a ripple effect on the South African market. Do we think that there might be other areas or other geographies around the world that could be sort of offsetting against that pressure that's being placed on China?
I hope so. I hope that, you know, maybe Southeast Asia, that area, comes in and perhaps covers, particularly, let's say, on the consumer side with luxury goods and that you see, you know, strong demand from other areas coming through. Funny enough, you know, luxury goods have started to bottom and are getting used to the fact that, you know, Chinese demand will settle down at a much lower level. But It's quite important, you know, and we've seen what's happened to Europe as a result. We're watching demand for motor vehicles, watching the demand for EVs globally as well, to see whether China does have some kind of impact or not. But it is it's something that's missing, and all the attempts that they are making to get things going hasn't quite caught on. Market's still very skeptical, so. We're going to watch. There are lots of people who believe it's very cheap. You know, we are having a discussion this morning. One chap at our firm said, listen, it's on a 5 PE versus US 20. you know, but it's on a 5p because people are nervous. But you know, if things do swing, then yeah, it you know, it could be a hidden factor and a positive factor. But for this, yeah, so we got a lot to talk about in the year to come.
Uncle David, what do you think is the catalyst for that? I mean, that discounted conversation has been going on for quite some time, and a lot of it has kind of stemmed from the involvement of the Chinese government in matters of markets that are supposedly supposed to be kind of a free environment that is free of political meddling. Do you think that there's something that needs to be said by the governing party in China to allay fears of markets, to say, we know we meddled the last time, but this time we promise we're not going to do it?
I don't think it's even the meddling. I think it's probably the property market there that is the biggest drag.
Mm.
You know, with 30-odd million people who have paid for property that can't get delivery, you know, can't get that, and massive issues around that. So I think that you know, that's what brought Japan down in you know, the 1990s, was the collapse of the property market, and this is proving to be equally as dangerous or as difficult. So I think that's the market we're all watching for, any kind of change in the property market. They're trying to get people to spend, you know, giving you a 15% discount on phones and trying to replace your washing machines, you know, it will give you a 20% subsidy and so on. So I think they're trying all kinds of things, but market's been slow to take these things up.
What about the local market? What do we have to look forward to for the year? I mean, we've touched on the infrastructure side of it. We're hoping resources come to the party. It seems financials and industrials have been under pressure as well. Obviously, industrials being the Naspers and Process, but financial stocks also, the Rand also not doing too well at this stage. What do we have that's in store for us this year?
I think a worry. You know, it's we've got to work a little hard this year to get things going. We haven't, you know, the catalyst hasn't come yet. I think we were all hoping that it would be on the commodity side, and that's not pulling through. But we've got to learn to work without it. The companies are still operational. They're still making profits, maybe at lower levels. But I think a lot more work has to do in getting confidence into this economy. And I don't know how to do that, Jimmy. I'll qualify it by saying we still got some very good businesses here who are still doing pretty well. If we start to see fixed investment taking place and projects of that nature taking place of a big man, you know, that in itself is has a multiplier effect on the rest of the market. What worried me, though, you know, was when I saw ArcelorMittal now closing down factories, you know, that has a negative effect. We've got to prevent those kind of things happening. It's ArcelorMittal's got a market cap of 1.4 billion. I mean, that's a mini cap. This is ArcelorMittal. You know, this is steel mills. Hold on a sec. Something's wrong. Something's got to give. You know, we've got to get fixed investment going. And I think you can see the same thing in the cement factories. So yeah, that to me is you know, the catalyst. And I just hope you have a good conversation with Investec, you know, and they give you something to hope for and to move forward on.
Well, we'll
money's there, hey? The money's there.
We'll certainly ask those questions. And hopefully Investec does give us those answers. But for now, we'll leave the conversation there. Thank you so much, Uncle David. Lovely to have you back. David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth joining us to take a look at the market movements as well as some of the market sentiment that might be lingering around.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As Uncle David did mention, that fixed investment outlook has come through from Investec. They've provided us with an outlook for the infrastructure focus that will be key towards South Africa's growth, particularly in 2025 and beyond. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Economist at Investec, Annabelle Bishop, to take a look at this, see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Annabelle. Lovely to speak to you. Compliments of the new year. A very good start to the year from a research point of view and from an information point of view. I mean, we know that these sorts of conversations have been going on for quite some time, but again, the focus is now very squarely on fixed investment. Why is that for this year?
Yes, hi. Happy New Year to you too. Yes, I think, you know, we really find ourselves in a situation now in South Africa where it's just become absolutely imperative that we can, you know, no longer see the country lagging behind in terms of economic growth, obviously very negative for unemployment, but particularly in terms of fixed investment. The reason I say that is we know what the problems are. There's been endless diagnostics in terms of what the issues are with fixed investment, infrastructure, economic growth, unemployment, and it's really, you know, been quite a while coming that we need to actually activate and start to repair, maintain, but particularly improve the delivery in South Africa from infrastructure.
Mm. Annabelle, when we look at the infrastructure side of it, obviously there's capital infrastructure and there's social infrastructure, things that are unavoidable, like dealing with the water scarcity or the water crisis that we have, and ensuring we have water security in South Africa is more of a social spend there, but it is necessary. How do we strike that balance now, understanding that capital infrastructure is also essential if we're going to stimulate growth?
Well, I think, you know, that's the key point. It's all types of infrastructure that are absolutely important. You mentioned water, and South Africa, as we know, is a water-scarce country. It's got half the average rainfall, you know, compared to the rest of the world, and of course a very high evaporation rate, and the potential to develop further water resources are quite limited. About three quarters of our exploitable water surface resources are already being used. So it's not just obviously the supply of water, but also, of course, more importantly for areas like Gauteng, it's the ability to deliver the water, the pipes, the infrastructure. Obviously this bulk infrastructure is something which has experienced deterioration right across the country, and of course as well we know that at Transnet there's heavy delays in terms of the port still, but also of course as well, you know, what's very worrying is that we continue to see a downward trend in terms of freight, and that's obviously on the railway line. You know, we did have some good news over the course of last year in terms of the trains, but if we look on a long-term basis, and that's what we're looking here, Jimmy, since 2022 there's been a downward trend in terms of freight transportation, and of course, you know, that's important to South Africa. Transporting freight is expensive. It's cheaper to do it by rail, and that obviously doesn't even include the deterioration costs on roads and highways. So overall, you know, to increase productivity in South Africa, to have a faster GDP growth rate, in other words, to employ more people, to reduce unemployment, we need to see economic growth running at 5% plus. And of course, for that to happen, we need to have the infrastructure to be able to cope with more activity. At the moment, it's not coping with the current activity.
Mm. Annabelle, speaking of that growth target, the 5% that we dream to achieve, that is very realistic if we get things right. Alongside the infrastructure that you've mentioned a lot of current things that are in place. We've also heard from the presidency, from the various government organizations, that there's new infrastructure projects that are coming online and all of that. How do you strike that balance from a development point of view to say we need to maintain, as you rightly said, the existing infrastructure for the existing demand before looking to add onto that demand, but also we need new infrastructure so that we can actually continue to grow. How do you strike that balance between current infrastructure and new infrastructure projects?
Well, you know, all of that is correct. We need to both maintain and improve the productive capacity of current infrastructure and also add in new infrastructure as well to reach faster economic growth. The presidency itself says that South Africa could have had economic growth of 4% last year and in 2023, instead of economic growth of below 1%, if we had Transnet fully operational and able to meet all the demand that businesses required of it, plus obviously being able to accelerate further. You know, just to give you an example, if you look at a mining house that is producing its minerals and metals, and obviously if they cannot get them exported out of the country, if they cannot sell them, then the mining house is going to have to cut back on the production it could make. And you know, either it stockpiles these metals and minerals, or obviously that's not very cost effective, it doesn't get anything for doing that, so then it tends to cut back employment. And you know, as your previous speaker was saying, we have this disaster now happening with the last metal. The bottom line for South Africa is that yes, we've managed to largely solve our electricity crisis, it's not over. The presidency again warns that we could have bouts of load shedding, but they appear to have broken the back of the problem. Transnet is something very different, Jimmy. You know, Transnet is not just as easy to fix as Eskom. Eskom, we saw a lot of the work done by original equipment manufacturers and providers. They obviously worked on improving the power station's productive capacity. People who obviously originally produced them, you know, ones like those in other countries, they obviously had the huge depth of skill and expertise to fix the crisis that we fell in with electricity and really restore those essentially a power station to machine to as much of the operating capacity as they could make. Now, of course, in Transnet, it's different. We have both the long railway systems in South Africa, which unfortunately targets some infrastructure crime and theft. And one of the solutions for South Africa will be to actually stop export of scrap metal in South Africa, not make it viable for criminals to dismantle infrastructure and sell it, whether to scrap metal dealers in South Africa or obviously for them to amalgamate it and send it overseas. That's something that needs to come to an end. Also, of course, as well, what's very important from our infrastructure in South Africa is looking at Transnet as well. They're going to break it down into different divisions, but also, of course, as well, the regulatory side to give certainty in terms of return and cost for private sector operators. But again, you know, can the existing infrastructure on the rail cope with a whole lot of new trains and operators? And of course, that's going to be a difficulty there as well. So as you can see, there's quite a lot of work that goes into it. And of course, you know, we need to find ourselves in a situation where South Africa does tackle crime to actually stop the stripping of our necessary infrastructure, but also, of course, as well, to bring in regulatory certainty and, of course, improve the outlook, improve the ability for private sector investment.
Annabel, from the private sector, and I'd like you to put on your advisory hat around this, how do we make it attractive? Because for the longest time, we've had the conversations. We've said South Africa is the investment destination. Bring the foreign direct investment here. This is where you need to invest your capital. How do we look attractive for infrastructure projects to the capital markets? Because as you said, this isn't easy. And I can imagine from a capital perspective, it certainly isn't cheap.
Well, it always comes back to the same thing, and that's risk and return. What are the risks involved? And of course, what return are you going to get on your investment? And the more certainty you have around that, the more likely you are to actually get investment, whether it's foreign investment or domestic private sector players investing in South Africa's infrastructure. And of course, from that perspective, you need regulatory certainty. Private sector investors need to know exactly what they're up against and exactly how they are going to be able to perform. But also, of course, as well, you know, a number of unknowns. We're talking, for example, about the railway system. If we do see a lot more rolling stock, a lot more carriages, you know, a lot more transport happening in South Africa, particularly for the rail side of it, you know, for volumes to go up, these investors, these operators need to know, is there sufficient rail capacity? You know, do they obviously have to wait, for example, in long lines at the ports, which is the current situation that we experience, and that, of course, reduces the profitability. So there are many factors which obviously go into it, not just obviously the regulations we're talking about and the state of the train set, the train tracks, you know, everything that the operators have to deal with, but also, of course, well, what happens on each end when they get to the ports themselves. So unfortunately, you know, we can't look at it in isolation. There'll have to be resolution of many of the issues happening at the ports as well to reduce congestion and free flow. And of course, it's all that may mean building more infrastructure, you know, building more lines in those areas. But there are many other factors that go into it as well. It's a multifaceted situation. It's not something which is simple and easy to unpack. And therefore, we would not expect to see issues of Transnet resolved this year, as, you know, perhaps people may well hope. It's going to take a number of years. We do expect fast economic growth this year. We're not all doom and gloom. We're looking for economic growth of 1.8% from 0.8% for GDP last year. The lift obviously comes, as we've been talking about a lot, from the repair and improvement of South Africa's infrastructure, whether it's investment in water infrastructure, whether it's capital spend, obviously, on the rail, the ports, etc. And also, let's not forget ongoing work in electricity production and distribution in South Africa. Transmission lines are very important to extending the transmission network across South Africa for electricity.
It's not all doom and gloom. We are expecting to have a good year. That is what economists are forecasting for the growth prospects of South Africa. It might be at 1.8%, but we know we can certainly do better. We just all have to put our heads together and get things off of the ground and get things moving. Thanks so much, Annabel, for those insights. Annabel Bishop, Chief Economist at Investec, on the infrastructure outlook or the fixed investment outlook from their perspective around that being a potential catalyst for good, stable economic growth in South Africa.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience, it's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, back in November, we took a look at the adjustments that were coming or potentially coming through in the form of potential tax changes to unit trusts. If you've missed that conversation, it is up on our website. The podcast is available there. We're going to be taking a look at that as well, once again, with the team at 361 Asset Management, because it is such a significant aspect of investors' portfolios, particularly when you look at collective investment schemes and how they are currently being managed. I'm joined on the line by the portfolio manager from 361 Asset Management, Stephen Hurwitz, to take a look at this. Good evening, Stephen. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by recapping and getting a bit of an understanding around the current tax structures related to unit trusts and collective investment schemes. How is it currently being seen by the revenue services?
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you very much for having me on this evening. So currently, how it works is that funds are required to make a distribution of income that they've earned to to the underlying investor. So that would be interest earned or dividends that have accrued. And then the underlying investor will have to include those distributions in their tax return. In terms of gains that are made on disposal of shares, for example, the treatment will be dependent on whether those gains are seen as capital or revenue from the fund's perspective. So if they are deemed to be revenue, the fund should pay them out also as a distribution, and then it will be taxed in the investor's hands in their own income tax return. But if they are capital, then the fund will not have to make any distribution. It will be exempt from any tax at a fund level. And then when the investor ultimately disposes of their units in the fund, after a couple of years, they will pay CGT on the cumulative gains that the fund has made over that period of time. So there is a significant benefit to being invested in a fund, given that it allows you to have this deferral of CGT.
Mm. Stephen, now under the new tax structures, the understanding here is that we're now moving to largely everything being revenue-based, or at least being part of revenue. Tell us about the significant difference that that creates, particularly from an ultimate beneficial owner or a taxpayer perspective or an investor perspective.
So there are a number of proposals that have been made, but ultimately what it does come down to is that most of the gains that a fund will be made will be treated as revenue in the underlying investor's hands. Now, the big issue here is that we get the sense that this is being rushed without considering the wide-ranging consequences of such a tax proposal, as there was only 1 month that people that were concerned had to make a submission to National Treasury. Now, South Africa has a shrinking tax base. This is clear from the stats that recently came out from SARS. There've been a large number of people that have financially immigrated to avoid being included in the SA tax net. And I think it's very important that we have policies that encourage savings and investment in South Africa. And unfortunately, this proposal does the opposite. Even the discussion document itself states that South Africa has a low savings rate.
So, Stephen, with a shrinking tax base and this seemingly shift, or the shift supposedly towards increasing tax from that shrinking tax base, what are the alternatives that could potentially be explored? Because this doesn't sound like it's the best move here.
In our view, it's not the best move. And I'll come back to what the alternatives are. But I think what's important to speak about before we get to the alternatives is the fact that this proposal suggests that we should follow a fully tax transparent regime, which is similar to what they have in Hong Kong and Switzerland. The big issue is that the discussion paper never takes it a step further and says, well, what does it look like from a taxpayer's perspective in Hong Kong and Switzerland? And in Switzerland, it all depends on whether you're classified as a professional securities trader or private investor. If you're a private investor, the gains are tax-free. And in order to be a private investor, you need to have held the shares for 6 months and your transaction volume must be less than 5 times the portfolio value, which is very different to Section 9C in the South African Income Tax Act, which says that you have to have held the shares for more than 3 years.
Mm.
Similarly, in Hong Kong, they have a very similar type of distinction. And in both of these cases, in Switzerland and in Hong Kong, if you are treated as a private investor, your gains are actually tax-free. So that's very different to a case in the scenario in South Africa, where if you are in the highest individual income tax bracket, on capital gains tax, you'd be paying 22.5%. And if it was treated as revenue, you'd be paying 45%. So yes, those other countries do have full pass-through, but when it comes to the tax treatment in the individual investor's hands, it ends up being tax-free. So I don't think that by taking those two countries, it necessarily should be applied the same in South Africa. Now, moving on to what we think the solution should be, we think that it should be very similar to what the United Kingdom has. So in the UK, all income is distributed to the underlying investors, and they have to include that income, whether it's interest or dividends, in their own income tax return. And capital gains, whether they are short-term or long-term holdings, are exempt from any tax consequences. And the investor only pays tax once they dispose of the units in the fund. And this encourages long-term savings, which is what South Africa needs. Now, interestingly, in the 2013 Draft Tax Laws Amendment Bill, there actually was a proposal, Section 101 DA, that stated that capital gains versus revenue is an unnecessary distinction, and that receipts and accruals of a portfolio should be exempt. So that would exempt any disposals from being included in the income tax. And this would align it to the UK treatment.
Stephen, what about the allocations? I mean, from an asset management point of view, asset managers for a large part are invested in things like unit trusts and collective investment schemes type investments as part of long-term strategies. Do you think that the adjustment in the tax treatment will affect how you as asset managers sit back and say, hang on, in the best interests of our clients and the returns, maybe we might not be as weighted on these products?
So ultimately, what our investors are going to be interested in is what is their after-tax return going to be. And as a result, if it means that we will have to buy or sell shares less frequently, it can result in much more inertia across the industry. And this can result in asset managers holding on to overvalued assets for longer, in order to try and avoid triggering tax. And this results in the misallocation of capital. I think that this is very negative for markets, as money should be attracted to the best opportunities out there. It also results in, I think, big structural issues in the industry where you have an entrenchment of market leaders. Larger, more established funds will generally have lower turnover anyway. And it will stifle competition and innovation in the industry. If the industry is to actually have further black economic transformation, it will be very difficult for emerging fund managers to outperform the larger managers and attract new assets without having the ability to trade more frequently.
definitely lots to consider. It's amazing how one adjustment to tax legislation has such a ripple effect on everything else. We'll have to wait and see what happens in that regard. We do know that we are expecting that budget speech in February. So for now, nothing's changed, but this could potentially be a change. I think we'll leave the conversation there. Thanks so much, Stephen, for the time and for the insights. Stephen Hurwitz, Portfolio Manager at 361.
I've been speaking to Aaron Chen, who's the CEO of Trust Wallet. That's got 160 million users worldwide. And we've been talking about this whole trend towards self-custody that's happening around the world. A lot of people prefer to keep their coins on a crypto exchange. It's convenient. But is it safe?
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We continue with the potential tax adjustments. We're taking a look this time at donations tax. So the South African Revenue Services has come out with an adjustment on how they are seeing gifts that are being sort of provided for or received by individuals, especially gifts of a large value. We're going to be taking a look at this. We're joined on the line by the head of CPD Consortium, Catherine Faree, to try and understand what's going on here. Good evening, Catherine. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with what a donation is. How do we define a donation under the current tax structures?
Good evening, Jimmy, and thank you so much for this opportunity. If we look at what a donation is, the first thing that we're looking at is a person has generally made a donation if they give something away for free. So the word we use is gratuitous. So that's what we would see as a gift. As you mentioned, generally when we are looking at the tax space, we're looking at a large gift. But it's something that's been given away without expecting anything in exchange. So an example could be I make a gift to the SPCA, or I give an apartment worth 5 million rand to my child for free. So it can be money or something other than money like shares or a car. But it's actually wider when we look at the donations tax legislation, because a person could be tempted to pretend that they're selling the asset so that they can avoid donations tax, and then they sell the asset for less than it's actually worth. So, for example, the parent doesn't want it to look like a donation, so they sell the apartment to their child for 1 million rand, even though they know the fair market value is actually 5 million rand. And if the commissioner is of the opinion that the person giving the donation hasn't received enough, then that piece that was for free is also seen as a donation.
Sounds like a very generous donation or a very generous gifting structure. I, for one, welcome anyone that wants to give me a 5 million rand apartment. I would not say no. But I want to look at the implications that this now has. From a gifting perspective and from a donations perspective, the South African Revenue Services has made it very clear that they are now going to, particularly where it relates to things of a higher value, put more emphasis and more scrutiny on whether or not these valuations and things were done properly. In the past, did we have any limitations on values and all of that from a threshold perspective?
That's a very important question. And I think the first thing to note is that the thing that we're really seeing and the reason that we are emphasizing this at the moment is the level of scrutiny that these donations are under. And so what we're seeing is that recently, towards the end of 2024, SARS issued a new form and they issued a new guide, but we're also seeing generally, and from their annual report that they also issued in November, that they're using increasingly sophisticated tools to identify tax transactions, including these types. So the main changes in legislation are really sitting on some of the more complicated anti-avoidance issues, specifically around trusts. But generally, our focus at the moment is within the current thresholds. And as we wait for the next round of changes, really that increased scrutiny where we might expect to see further verifications or audits from SARS, and really that huge drive for taxpayer compliance.
Mm. Catherine, speaking of the scrutiny, I mean, you mentioned the new form that's being introduced. I want to look at that. Who's responsible for completing that form? Is it the donor or the gifter or the recipient of the gift/donations? Is it both parties? What we know for sure is the contents of that form has now become exceptionally onerous, to the extent that if you're gifting something like a motor vehicle, they might even require how many kilometers that vehicle has done. Who's responsible for these documents or completing these forms? Forms, and just how interested is SARS in the information that's in those forms?
Absolutely. So the person is responsible for donations tax, and therefore responsible for ensuring that the returner submitted is the donor. So it's the person who is giving that gift, the parent who is donating the apartment to their child, a person who is making a donation to a trust, for example. And so they or their representative would then make sure that they are compliant and that they pay the taxes that are required. And it's quite important that donations tax is separate to income tax. So that's something that we have to remember, because you can't just wait till the end of your tax year and then phone your tax practitioner. Because the tax has to be paid by the end of the month after the donation has been made. So if I gift that apartment in December, I have to calculate and pay the donations tax along with the IT-144, which is the form, by the end of January, so by the end of the following month. So it's different timing, and it's quite a lot to think about.
Catherine, what about the exemptions? I remember there were exemptions that used to apply to donations. If I remember correctly, things around public benefit organizations, spousal exemptions, I think maintenance and contributions as well was on that list. Do those exemptions still stand? Are they still in place, or are they also going to be affected by the nature and the value of these gifts now?
Jimmy, I really hope not. we really hope. I think the exemptions have really important reasons. And so I'm just going to touch on the main ones. There's quite a long list. And it's so important, because as soon as a donation is exempted, then we don't have to pay donations tax. Sometimes it's only a part exemption. And that, for me, probably is the most important one. So for a natural person, you can donate 100,000 Rand in the year of assessment. So that runs from the 1st of March to the end of February of the next year, and there's no donations tax payable. And so that one is a super important one, and it also means that we don't have to panic if we perhaps celebrated over the festive season and gave some generous gifts. So that 100,000 Rand applies to every natural person. There's just a couple of important things there. So the first one is, it's a use it or lose it. So if I don't use the 100,000 Rand exemption this year, I can't take it forward and say, oh, well, I'll donate 200,000 Rand next year. Mm. You use it in that year of assessment and only then. And the other thing that's super important is we need to keep our documentation in order around the donations that we make and our justification that they are exempted, because It's the taxpayer or the donor's job to make sure that they can show that that was actually exempted. And we often see this also with trusts. So, for example, with family trusts, they're really under the microscope at the moment. And so those donations need to be carefully documented and properly compliant. So that 100,000 for me, very, very important. Then a donation to a spouse, fully exempted. So that means that a person can give, and it's not a capped amount, to their spouse, and there's no donations tax to pay. We always have to be careful with tax, though, because if the reason that the donation was made was to avoid another tax like income tax, then we could end up with anti-avoidance legislation kicking in. But the actual donation itself is not going to be subject to donations tax. The PBOs, as you mentioned, so close to my heart. The public benefit organizations are making such a difference, and if we make a donation to a public benefit organization that is also exempted, so there's no donations tax there, that's separate to the income tax deduction that a taxpayer might enjoy if they get their Section 18A receipt, which is obviously also super important because it encourages us to contribute to that really important work. And then the final one that I wanted to mention, because I think so many people do this, is if we make contributions for the reasonable maintenance of any person, then that's also not subject to donations tax. It doesn't have to be a family member. It can be any person. So, for example, we contribute to the school fees of a child or we assist an elderly person. The only thing about that one is it's subject to the discretion of the commissioner. So we can pay our child's university fees and that should be fine. But if we give them a Ferrari, then the commissioner is probably not going to agree that that's exempted.
It's always important to speak to a tax advisor around these conversations. That's why they exist, especially when it comes to such complex matters. We'll leave the conversation there, Catherine. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Catherine Furry, head of CPD Consortium, on the latest pronouncements from SARS around donations tax.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's the first Wednesday of the year for us and for the SAFM market update, and we're going to have our first executive join us today. We're joined on the line by the CEO of Galletti Corporate Real Estate, John Jack, to get a bit of a better understanding of what he does when he's not running such a big business. Good evening, John. Thanks so much for taking the time. How did you get into property, John?
Interesting question, actually. So both of my parents were in property, ultimately. My father more in the development side and a little bit in the commercial side in the end. And my mother's been in residential property for, well, as long as I can remember. She actually works for Pam Golding Property. So I've learned so much from her over the years, you know, and I kind of repeat it to everyone in the office all of the time. But both of my parents were in property.
What's that dynamic like, John, when you have a conversation with your mum and you realize that you technically work for the competition or you set up and run the competition? Is there any awkwardness there?
No, not at all. I mean, my mother's really residential focused and has been, operates in the Simonstown market for the Pam Golding office. And we're really sort of a national commercial business. So there's not an overlap at all. You know, sometimes there might be a property. You know, I had a laugh the other day. We picked up a property for sale in our auction business across the road from her office. And I didn't say anything. And then the next thing, we slapped up a huge sign that's going on property by Galletti. And I got a very quick phone call from her, you know. But no, there's no awkwardness. I think really what happens is, you know, you start off as the student. And now, you know, she sort of phones me with her own challenges she might be having in a transaction or something in the business, where I'm able to add my own insight given the experience I have in the industry, which is quite interesting. Now there's an equal dynamic, you know. I'm teaching her things that she taught me.
John, what would you say is the most rewarding thing about kind of being in the space that you're in, whether it's from a community point of view, whether it's from a deals point of view? What do you enjoy most about what you do?
I think there are two very clear things for me. So one is the people that we work with, and just watching that growth of the people in the business and learning, and for them to become successful in their own careers and able to create something for themselves. We have a lot of fun in our business. It's certainly one of the things that we value as a culture. We love having fun. We love sort of that sort of environment in the office. So that I massively enjoy. But the other thing is just being that creativity aspect of it. I love being creative in transactions. I love being creative in our marketing. And so those two aspects I'm very involved in, both in a deal-making perspective, looking at the client's portfolio, looking to see how we can understand it, restructure it, you know, create simplicity in the deals that we're putting together creatively. And then the other aspect, working closely with our marketing team to try and communicate our message to the market. You know, I love that type of thing. I love coming up with new ideas and putting them together and having our very talented team curate them in a way that we both think looks good and perhaps speaks to the audience that we're trying to speak to, and connecting with that market. Those two things stand out for me as probably some of the most interesting stuff that we do.
John, what does fun look like outside of the office?
Outside of the office? I've been lucky enough to have a career and an upbringing where we've got a really interesting and sort of diverse group of mates and in different things. I've got mates who are shipping brokers and futures traders, and one of the guys runs a hedge fund. Another guy runs a video media group. Another guy's in production into Africa. So we've got lots of very, very successful mates around you. And I think that's probably something as a general takeout to anyone really, is to have those people around you that sort of interest you and that are creative and that inspire and push you. And they all have, they come from different places across the country that we met. And I was lucky enough to go to Stellenbosch University, which teaches you a particular kind of fun. And and I think those guys have kind of stayed together, and we try and do as much as possible around the country if we can, surfing if we can, walking that Pondo Trail if we can, getting together to go crayfishing if we can. But really just spending good time together with good and interesting people around you is probably my idea of fun.
John, where's the one place you've traveled to that you've enjoyed the most?
I love Greece, to be honest. And recently I've just come back from Mallorca. My sister happens to live in Mallorca. Quite similar but different. Obviously they have their different cultures, different foods, different beaches and that kind of thing to explore. But I'm one who loves to be near the water, in or near the water. So if I can be, Mallorca was a great one because you literally will arrive and you'll pick a spot in the distance and just swim there, so that's a great one. And in Greece you do the same thing. You can actually swim, you can go on a holiday in Greece, a booked package, and swim between islands. So for me, those type of things are fantastic. And then, of course, in Greece, the culture is fantastic. People are so warm and excited to host you at their, every restaurant kind of feels like it's its own family. You're going almost to their home, and they really treat it like that. They want to make it a special experience for you. So the people are great. Those are two places I really loved visiting, outside of the East, which is a whole completely different thing. And outside of going to the, some of the more developed countries, they all offer something different. But in my mind, as a holiday destination, Mallorca and Greece have been two fantastic ones to visit.
Mm-hmm. John, are you reading anything at the moment?
What have I just finished? I've read some interesting ones on the fiction side. I read some of Con Eagleden's stuff, which is really fascinating. It's like a period drama type of book, which is probably similar to a Ken Follett's Pillars of the Earth, or Wilbur Smith, one of our local writers, something like that. But it deals with Genghis Khan. The other series deals with Julius Caesar. So it's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant read. So that's the fiction side. And then on the sort of business side, what have you read recently? I love Jim Collins' Good to Great. I think that's a foundational and excellent book to read. Who else have we read? Amp It Up, another exciting book to read. I love reading. I'm always reading something. So,
what's your favorite book that you'd say you've read? Or your favorite piece of literature, I suppose?
In a business sense or in a fiction sense?
Either one.
Yeah. I think in a fiction sense, the Ken Follett's Pillars of the Earth series or trilogy or whatever you want to call it was just unbelievable. I mean, I can't believe that someone's actually written a book with so much detail, so much accurate detail, going back and then wound a narrative around it. I thought that was just a really interesting book to read. But just thinking back about it, one of my favorite books that I've read, if I go back, all the way, one of the favorite books I read, and I think this has got so many fantastic life lessons in it, is a book called The Celestine Prophecy. And it's just such an interesting book because what it teaches you is that people steal one another's energy, basically. There are lots of people out there, and people are either aggressive to you or they're aloof or they're, there's something going wrong in their life constantly and they're taking your energy. Basically, what the book's telling you to do is go and get your own energy from just getting outdoors, basically doing the things that love you and that you love and naturally inspire you, as opposed to looking to other people to take their energy. It's a very simple message written in quite a colorful book, but that was one of the books I read, probably standard 9 or 8, and it just taught me something in my life, to go and generate your own interest and energy as opposed to taking it from other people or relationships. Or
Go and get your own energy. It is vital to do that. Thanks so much, John, for that. It's been a pleasure getting to know you. That was John Jack, CEO of Galletti Corporate Real Estate, joining us for our executive lounge this week. It's just gone 7 o'clock, so Greg Coase is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.